This is the Thirsty Developer, episode number 10 for January 30th, 2008, Globalizing and Localizing. Welcome, everyone, to episode number 10 of The Thirsty Developer. I'm Dave Boss, coming to you from Studio DG, and up there in Studio M is my good friend Larry Clarkin. Hello, Larry. How are you doing today?
Doing great, Dave. How are you?
Fabulous. So today's interview is actually with Matt Goble from Crowd Chizik, and he's going to discuss with us some of the work that he's done on a recent project of his where they needed to implement some globalization and localization features. Larry had an opportunity to talk to him, but before we get into that, first and foremost, I just want to apologize to all of our listeners. We're a couple days late getting the show out, and for good reason, both Larry and I have been a little bit busy this week, huh, Larry?
Yeah, we've been hunkered down working on an internal presentation for a conference we've got coming up internal to Microsoft here. Also, Dave, you've been doing a little blogging lately.
Slightly. It seems like once I try to get blog posts that are meaningful out there, and it seems like once I actually hunker down and start writing my blog posts, they tend to turn into somewhat of a novel. So hopefully some good information there. But
that was a great blog post you had on, you know, rewriting URLs and, you know, basically how to deal with extensions on blogs.
Yeah, yeah. So our good friend down there in Phoenix, Tim Heuer, kind of called me out in one of his blog posts where he was responding to somebody's blog post about respecting somebody wrote a blog post about how you should not have file types in your URLs for blog posts, because if you ever decide to change your blog engines, you can kind of screw up URLs if you go from blog engine software to blog engine software. And each engine has kind of its own unique way of handling URLs. And there's kind of a somewhat standard way of handling blog URLs, but not everybody's following those particular standards. They kind of do it their own little ways, and there's kind of tricks around these different things. But anyways, Tim called me out for a certain way that I was handling my transition from community server to WordPress, and I felt inclined to kind of reply about that. So I kind of put that up there on my blog at daveboss.com about, you know, how I go about handling, you know, my old URLs from my previous blog post of the community server engine and you know, made that available for the new WordPress stuff. So it was kind of a good exercise for me to go through to kind of relive the pain and that it was to get that working. But hey, it works, and we're moving forward.
Yeah, and now you've captured it for prosperity. So
that's right.
You know, anybody who wants to look at it going forward, got a place to go.
Yep. So so we've been a little busy, and actually, kind of looking at our calendars going forward here, we're not slowing down at all, are we?
Nope.
I mean, we have both. There's a couple of things, actually, you know, there's a couple of internal things that we have going on, one of which I think is going to kill both of us. We have our sort of this internal technical conference that we're going to in Seattle at the beginning of February. But also at the end of February, we both have a team offsite in Vegas for a couple of days. But we're going home for a couple of days and then coming right back to Vegas for the Mix conference.
Yeah, I think the first one is just kind of a, you know, reconnaissance mission, you know, to kind of check out where we're going to hang out. So
that's right. I'm kind of scared, you know, going to Vegas twice within a week and a half time frame is liable to kill me. So hopefully we're able to survive.
The warrants will still be outstanding for you, Dave.
I won't be outside the state long enough for them to give up the chase, right?
But even before all that stuff in February, you still got to wrap up this week, Dave.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, this week we have the Sleepless in Chicago event happening Friday and Saturday in downtown Chicago. And this is actually kind of it's part SharePoint training and part SharePoint competition. Essentially what it is we're working in cooperation with Infusion out of New York, who's putting on these events all across the United States. And it's some SharePoint training kind of on a Friday, and then a Friday night we go out and have dinner, and then we break people up into teams, and it becomes a SharePoint development competition from that point. They kind of have a problem statement that they work on. And so Saturday morning, they're going to present kind of their solutions to the problem statement that they're given Friday night, and the winners will get a chance to go to have an all-expense-paid trip to the Office DevCon in San Jose in February, where they'll be part of a larger competition where they'll go up against the winners from the other cities from this Sleepless event. And the winners of the Office DevCon development competition will actually win some incredible prizes. I mean, one of the prizes is a paid trip to Redmond to visit the SharePoint team, in addition to an Alaskan cruise, which is kind of nice. Or they can choose a racing weekend in Las Vegas, or they have an opportunity to win a home theater system. So some pretty cool prizes to, you know, sling your SharePoint skills against.
Yes, sir.
So With that, you know, kind of bringing it back to Vegas, you know, we are going to the Mixed Conference, both of us. And what we'd like to know is find out, you know, who in the listening audience is actually going to be at Mixed Conference as well. We're looking at possibly having a listener meetup. So if you're going to the Mixed Conference, let us know. Shoot us an email, thirstydeveloperlive.com, and we'll figure out, you know, we'll pick one of the nights. We'll get together, go have some cocktails, share some stories, and just have a great time in Vegas. So if you're going to Mix, let us know. Send us an email, thirstydeveloperlive.com. And in addition to that, I'm also going to South by Southwest, which, you know, butts up against Mix. So I'll be going straight from Vegas to Austin, Texas. So if you're going to South by Southwest, you know, once again, shoot us an email, thirstydeveloperlive.com. We'd love to meet up with you. We'll have our podcast equipment, so hopefully we can get some interviews out of it.
Yeah, and it's not too early to start thinking about Tech Ed. That's going to be another opportunity for us to meet with some of the listeners, but also to record some great podcasts, too.
Right, so they're doing an interesting thing with Tech Ed this year, which I'm actually applauding. They're taking, you know, the Tech Ed conference in the past has kind of been, I would say, 75% IT pro focused and 25% developer focused. And, you know, PDC has typically been known for as the developer conference, but PDC, as you know, is usually focuses on future looking technologies, say things are like 18 months to 2 years out or even more, where Tech Ed's kind of like the here and now technologies. But it had such a small focus on sort of the developer side. What they did this year is they split the two audiences up, and they're having a Tech Ed developers conference 1 week, and the following week they're having the Tech Ed IT Pro conference. And hopefully, you know, we're looking to go to Tech Ed developers yet. We haven't got the confirmation on that yet. But if we do, we'll be surely, once again, you know, we'll try to have some sort of meetup and do some podcasts. So with that, I think we need to move on to a blog you should know, Larry.
Yep. So this what blog week, should you know today, Dave?
So actually, sort of sitting on that Mix theme, we've been talking to quite a bit. The blog that I picked this week is actually the Mix blog, which is at visitmix.com. They actually have some very interesting things going on leading up to the Mix conference. A couple of them are some design competitions. You have an opportunity to redesign the Mix site, and they'll pick a winner, and they'll fly that winner out to the Mix conference for an all expense paid trip to the Mix conference. They also have a style competition around a screensaver software that was developed by some of the technical evangelists in Redmond. There's this program called Flotsam. It's a screensaver built in WPF, and they had this application running last year as kind of like the in-between sequences between keynotes and breakouts. And it's a screensaver that kind of goes out to the Twitter feeds and goes out to the Facebooks and grabs all that information, kind of displays it. Well, they're looking for people to kind of come and restyle that WPF application. And you have a chance to win an Xbox from that. So those are all listed on visitmix.com. But one thing that I want to point out from this blog is they actually have a podcast called The Signal. And The Signal is all about, it's a podcast all about talking with the Mix speakers and some of the people who are around putting the Mix conference together. And it's actually some pretty great information. So if you're going to the Mix conference, definitely check it out. And even if you're not going to the Mix conference, definitely check out the Visit Mix website, because as they did last year, what they're going to do is they're going to take all of the content, all the breakout sessions, the keynote sessions, and they're looking to do a 24-hour turnaround to get all of those sessions posted up online at visitmix.com. So definitely keep your eye on visitmix.com for some great information for the Mix conference. So Larry, how about your blog? Which blog should we know this week?
So I kind of picked up on the whole Signal podcast idea, and I thought I would go with one of my favorite blogs, which is the Signal versus Noise blog by 37 Signals. 37 Signals is a local Chicago-based company. They're, you know, great bunch of guys. They've got some great design and usability ideas. In their, you know, on the side, you know, in addition to creating great applications, they actually create a little framework for the web called Ruby on Rails. Perhaps you've heard of it.
Never. What is it again?
So yeah, 37 Signals. You know, they don't use any Microsoft technology, but I think that you know, all developers have a lot of things in common, and you know, learning about usability and design is a great thing for developers to do, and that's one of my favorite blogs. Every time I get a post from them, I run right over and read it.
Yep. They got some great information over there. I actually invite everybody out there to, you know, what are some blogs that we should know? You know, simply send us your favorite blogs to thirstydeveloperlive.com, and hopefully we can check those out and highlight them on one of the future shows. So with that, Larry, I think we need to move into this week's interview. Do you want to kick us off here?
Yeah, so I had a chance to sit down with Matt Goble from Crochizic and talk about globalization and localization. They created this smart client application for one of their customers, and you know, it's a really cool, full-featured smart client application. It's got all the things that you'd expect from it, you know, like click once deployment and all that. one of the challenges they had is after the product was out there and running, they actually had to start adding additional languages to the application. And as you know, Dave, that can be a little bit of a challenge.
Slightly.
Yeah. So we talked about some of the challenges that you face there and some of the kind of best practices that you can follow to get that done easily. And Matt and the guys down at Crow's have come up with some really creative ideas to address some of the challenges.
Great. So let's roll your interview with Matt Goble.
This is Larry Clarkin, and I'm sitting here with Matt Goble at the Indianapolis offices of Crow Chiswick. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
So, Matt, we were talking yesterday about this really cool smart client application you built for a customer of yours, and I thought the most interesting part about it was the multilingual support.
Right. It's an application that's actually distributed worldwide, and it has language support for 7 different languages now, and that includes English, German, French, Italian, Spanish, Russian, and Chinese Mandarin.
Yeah, and I don't think your typical developer in the United States has run into a lot of multilingual, the need for multilingual applications unless they're a web developer doing, something worldwide. But I think it's going to become an increasingly important skill for developers, especially in the U.S., as we see globalization of companies and, quite frankly, as the world gets smaller.
Oh, absolutely. We see it, and more and more clients are starting to request popular languages like Spanish and such.
Yeah, I mean, even within the United States, the application doesn't necessarily have to, be distributed worldwide. There's a big enough Spanish-speaking population here that it's going to become an issue.
Right.
So let's talk about, as a .NET developer, and specifically this is a WinForms application.
Correct.
Said it was originally built on 1.1, but you ported it to 2.0?
That's correct. It was originally built on 1.1, utilizing like MSDE in the back end, and we're now moved up from that to the 2.0 framework using SQL Server 2005 Express and support Vista now. So, I mean, it's come a long way from its first generation.
So, when I'm typically in a WinForms application and I go over to my tool bar and I grab, like a label and I drag it onto the page, I could set the text in there. And by default, of course, because I'm an English-speaking person, I'm going to set it as English. But when I run that, I've got to make sure that if somebody's running it from a different language, that I see their language. What do I have to do, beyond the typical, just grab the controls and start putting them on the form?
Well, I mean, that's where the power of Visual Studio really comes into play and is really helpful with its globalization and localization abilities. With that, it's relatively simple. It's there's a property on every form. It's called globalize or localizable, I believe. And it's just a Boolean. And upon setting that to true, you get language options. All the cultures and all the languages in the world represented by a unique ID called an LCID. And with setting that, you're able to generate a specific resource file per language.
Okay. So I flip the magic bit, and then when I drag the label on there, me being an English person and, my Visual Studio is set to run in English, I could still just set the property on the text. But behind the scenes, there's a ResX file that actually stores that string for me, right?
Correct. The ResX file by default the default ResX file will store all your native language. So whatever you input there, just normal, right? So if you were programming and you were writing it in, say, Russian, for example, it would be in Russian. Or if you're in English, it would obviously be in English. By switching that bit and then dragging the label in, those values, everything on that form, all the properties for every control is being written out to the ResX file. That then, when you switch languages, changes which ResX files it's writing to. So, for example, if you have a form called MyForm, it's MyForm.ResX is your default. And then, say if you're in Spanish, it'd be MyForm.ES.ResX. And that's where all the properties for all your Spanish. So if you switch it to Spanish, you could just type right into the Visual Studio editor and be able to make your changes and your position layout moves for that Spanish edition right there, and it writes out to the specific ResX file.
Well, that's kind of cool. So I would actually, specify what additional languages that I support, but I'm not, I'm not fluent in any other language other than English. And maybe Visual Basic.
Well, I wish I could say I was fluent in the 7 that the program's in now, but I'm also not.
Yeah, and even if you understand Spanish, or understand a second language, you're probably, your skill is being a developer. You probably want to get it to somebody who's actually a professional translator, right?
Absolutely. We use a translation house that we ship all the strings off to, They translate it and then bring it back. We actually, to speed this process up, since translators typically don't have Visual Studio installed, nor would they take the time to understand how to use Visual Studio or would I want them touching the code base, we've written an application to kind of automate the process. A simple, quick application that reads the ResX files, and it's just a key value pair, and we strip that out, store it into an Excel file, hide the key fields that we need, send off that Excel file to the translators. The translators can quickly make translations from column to column, send that back to us, and then upon receiving it, we have the application that we wrote just quickly feed all those new translated values back into the specific ResX file. That speeds up the process immensely, seeing that it's all automated and we can dump thousands of string values into the program within seconds.
Oh, that's a neat idea because, you know, like you said, the translator doesn't have Visual Studio, so they don't have anything that understands the native ResX format. Pretty much everybody has Excel or something that can read Excel files. And I think the most important thing there was you actually, hid the values that Visual Studio keys on so that the translator can't accidentally break those kind of things.
Right. We were kind of worried that they would look at it and try to translate those columns, which, of course, are all very cryptic-ish kind of column names, keys.
Yeah. And one of the other things that if you haven't done, I've participated in a globalization project in a past life before coming to Microsoft. And, one of the things that I don't think, if you haven't done it, that's kind of surprising is that the length of the phrase can change dramatically. Something that's a very short word in English, particularly when you go into this, like the Scandinavian languages, if it's an 8-character word here, it could actually be, a 20, 25-character word. And that can kind of, mess with the layout of your form. So tell us how in Visual Studio, how is the length of the label, or the other fields in there controlled, as part of this globalization translation process?
Oh, absolutely. We ran into this primarily with German and Russian the most. Very wordy languages. We also found out that Russian doesn't have a lot of abbreviations. So where we were abbreviating stuff in English, we ran into issues with translation as well as just they were putting the full word and where we only had abbreviations in English to begin with. Visual Studio helps with that as well, simply because not only are the strings for each language stored in their specific ResX file, but the positioning and layout is also stored. So by simply going into your form designer, you can switch over to that specific language that you're working with and then start dragging the controls around the form, sizing them differently, repositioning stuff, and all that information is being stored specifically for that language. So that means when you run the application, if you run it in English, it's going to look like it always looks. And say you run it into German, you might have a completely different size form or a completely different spacing criteria just based off of how you've had to size it to fit all your information in to the form.
So you can, just to feed back to you, if it doesn't look right, after the translation, you can actually, reorder it. And that may be something where you have a human factors type person, somebody who says, it'll be a lot more understandable, if this form looks like that because of the language translation, right?
Absolutely. We have testers in all six of the other countries that we have languages for. And we ship it off to them just so they can take a look at it and say, no, this doesn't make any sense. Or when I translated this, this was in a different context. I was thinking you were using it in a different context because we run into that a lot where the business domain of this application causes a lot of confusion because it's a very technical business domain, electrical engineering. And as part of that, the translation, when the words are taken out of context or in a different context, the translator thought we were trying to use it for, it can mean something completely different.
Yeah, so the translator doesn't know, of course, Visual Basic or whatever language you're using, C# or whatever. They don't also understand necessarily all of the ins and outs of the domain language. So what you really, the ideal person to work on your project would be, one person from each of the seven languages who had an electrical engineering degree that was also a .NET developer, right?
If they existed, yes, that would be ideal.
You would, and if any of our listeners have got those skills,
contact me.
Contact you, yeah. But, and I guess that, that's one of the things that's kind of tough, right, is, it's almost an iterative process, right? The translator, your professional translating house, does the, translation, but then somebody with the domain knowledge has to look at it and go, ooh, no, that's not right. That's not what that meant.
Right, absolutely. And it's and that was probably the hardest part in the translation process. Technically, it wasn't all that challenging after we got over a few hurdles, which we can talk about later, but it was really that domain testing that became tricky because you had to find a translator first that could translate it. Then you had to find a domain expert to then go check the domain. And you have to be really careful about that because in certain languages, if, you know, you misspell something or, you know, can, you could possibly cause offensive or just make no sense and your program looks nonsensical.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that you have to, you know, really embrace is the culture. And one of the other things that I know the ResX file supports is, like, you can store images in there. At first when I was doing, you know, my first globalization effort, I was like, why are images in there? And somebody told me that, you know, if you've got a logo on your form or something like that or some, you know, bitmap or GIF that you're using, the colors in that GIF are important when you take it international. The classic example is in Saudi Arabia, you're not supposed to use the color green, I believe is what it is, because that is the color of the royal family. So unless you're doing something, you know, for the royal family, you're not allowed to, you know, use green. So you have to have a different image, you know, for those type of countries. And there's a lot of little cultural rules like that that you, you know, you should look up or have somebody who understands those things, you know, as you're doing it.
Well, I guess fortunately we haven't run into that yet. They are talking about going into Arabic as the next language in the process. However, I guess unfortunately, we have a pretty standard gray form right now. We're looking to spruce that up here in some of our next releases.
So actually, that's another interesting thing. You know, you're going into a language that is now it's going to be right to left as opposed to left to right.
Correct.
So that'll be another thing that you have to, you know, look for, you know, in the form itself. So
that's going to pose a whole new array of challenges for us.
So we've talked a lot about translating strings, and you know, one of the other best practices that, you know, I've run into is developers love to, like, just like throw a message box here and there every once in a while, right? You know, and probably not a good practice, you know, regardless, but it can make you know, translation really tough. That, you know, if you have just a message box and you hard code a string value in here, it's generally some cutesy little error message that somebody put in there, right? You know, the oops error message, press OK to continue kind of thing. You know, your best practice is you're not supposed to be putting strings in your code like that anyway, strings that are displayed to the user. Any other things like that that you've run into?
Well, I mean, for sure, the hard-coded strings is a, I guess, architectural thought that will really help you out if you know you're going to be writing a multilingual application up front. If you already have a mature application that you all of a sudden have to take multilingual, you could have more fun with it simply because you're going to have to search your entire application looking for these hard-coded strings. We got around that by simply moving all of our strings that weren't in ResX files natively by Visual Studio, moving them into one class and actually creating ResX files off of that class and then having properties return not just a hard-coded string but returning the ResX file that was currently loaded for that language that the operating system was running. Other things we've run into that has caused us some scratching of the heads was around numeric formatting. For example, I believe it's Russian and English. If you look at those formatting of their numbers, you know, their decimal places, where we would look at a decimal place as a comma and a comma as a decimal place, kind of switching around. Same thing with dates. Dates aren't always formatted the same way around the world. So we had to overcome some of those hurdles around those objects.
Yeah, 12/4/2008, if you look at the you know, the short date format, 12/04/08, in the United States you'd say, oh, that's December 4th. In France, for example, because I know French is one of your languages, that's April 12th. And that really creeps people out the first time, you know, they run into that. If you store the information in, you know, a SQL Server like you guys are doing, it's taken care of for you automatically. But you said you guys had a specific challenge because you actually save all of your information off to a file that can actually be, you know, shipped around the world. So when you store it in the file, if you just take the native date format, you might have some translation issues. How did you guys tackle that?
The way we got around that is, for the numbers and the dates is we always store down to the file. In the English by default. We then, upon pulling it back out of the file, due to the fact that any user around the world, close to 15,000 now, So you could have a user from China save a file and ship it off to somebody in France, open it up, save it, and ship it off to somebody through email in the U.S., and they can all have to open it using three different languages and three different display types. So we found that the best and easiest way was just to simply save it off as English, and then we knew exactly how to pull it out, and then we would display it based on the user's operating system settings for, like, you know, short date time, for example, or their settings for the globalization and their numeric values.
Well, that's a pretty cool way of tackling that problem. Want to move in a little bit into testing, because you hit on some best practices when we were talking before we started recording. You know, tell us about your spreadsheet.
Okay, well, the developers that were working on the project at the time, at our desk, we each had a list of the languages, the LCID for quick jumping into the testing environments, as well as a breakdown of things we were just talking about. Things like the numeric formatting or the date formatting, because you would not be surprised how many times I would be looking at a language and you switch to another language, and by the time you switch to your fourth language testing the same thing, you've all of a sudden forgotten what language you're in and what the format's supposed to be. So the cheat sheets really helped out just as far as every time you're in the code or every time you're testing, just to be able to quickly glance at it and say, okay, the decimal place is wrong here or whatever.
And your application, you know, normally, you know, when I start a .NET application, it's been, you know, localized and, you know, globalized and localized. It's going to come up in whatever language the OS is installed at. So, you know, U.S. English in the case of my copy of Vista. Your application, you can actually switch the language on the fly, right?
That's correct. By default, .NET, when it starts, it actually just reads the current culture and language LCID of the operating system. However, what we were tasked with by our client is that they wanted anybody in the world to run any language. So what we've done then to get around that is, upon starting the application, we simply control the LCID or the culture that thread runs under. Upon changing that, everything else that loads or is run past that is automatically picked up as whatever culture we set or whatever LCID we set. And doing so, you can have a English PC and you can run the application, say, in Chinese or to Russian or French or German or Italian or Spanish.
So I know when you spin off a new thread in .NET that each thread can actually have its own LCID associated with it. And did you guys run into any issues with that?
Yeah, we actually did initially. Every thread spins off, re-inherits the culture from the operating system. So upon spinning off, we have two cases where we spin off new threads in the application. And each time we have to set the culture there as well. We were kind of befuddled the first time when we would run the application, set only the main thread, and then half of our stuff would come back in the language we wanted and the other half wouldn't. And we was kind of scratching our heads like, well, why is it only half? So
yeah.
We found out that the other thread that was bringing back the other half of the values was actually still in the native OS culture.
Cool. So you can do most of your testing, you know, just using your copy of of Vista or XP, you know, set to, you know, English US. Were there any issues with that as far as, you know, being able to test? Did you actually need to have like an install of, you know, Spanish?
Yeah, initially we didn't have this feature to be able to switch between languages. So the way we started testing, and actually I still suggest this because there are differences between a Spanish copy of XP versus an English copy of XP, especially when you go into the acrylic languages or to double byte like Chinese. There are vast differences in the way that the forms behave on those operating systems. As such, we actually utilized VPCs or virtual PCs to install a copy of the operating system in its native language. So, for example, a German version of XP, a German version of 2000, Vista, etc., across this collection of VPCs we now have, and we were able to quickly boot into one of those VPCs, install the application, run our test.
Yeah, and VPCs have got to make that a lot, you know, easier. Back in the day, 10 years ago when I was doing this, we actually had, you know, if we were doing it in three or four languages, we actually had to have three or four PCs there on your desk, and it made for crowded workspace.
Right. I couldn't imagine having a stack of, well, you know, you got seven PC or seven languages and you got three operating systems. So, you know, having a stack of 21 PCs laying around, I'm not sure if I would have any desk room space.
Yeah, and when I did that, I didn't even have a KVM. I literally had, you know, four keyboards sitting on my desk. So, you mentioned some minor differences in the operating systems. You know, for the most part, you know, are those user experience type of things, or are those things that could actually befuddle your application?
Well, especially something you have to be careful of in the .NET 1.1 framework is an issue that doesn't necessarily support Chinese very well. There's quite a few knowledge base articles, and it's been a while since I've refreshed my memory, so I won't try to get into detail on them. However, due to the DPI issue and the screen resizing of the Chinese forms, a Chinese version of XP will display and render forms very differently than a English version of XP running the application in Chinese.
Okay.
Has to do with DPI settings as well as the auto size, which was introduced in .NET 2.0 with auto sizing on the text and layout.
So you mentioned that was a framework 1.1 issue that's completely resolved in 2.0 and higher?
Yes, correct.
Cool. Well, I think we've covered a lot of stuff. We've got a lot of good best practices out there for our listeners. Anything else you want to cover off that we missed?
I'm not sure. Not at this time. I think we covered most of it.
Great. You got a blog?
No, unfortunately, I do not. I keep getting pushed by my friends to get one, so eventually I will, but not right now.
Matt, you got to get a blog.
I know.
So you can share this great wisdom with our listeners.
All right. Well, if I do, I'll shoot you an email and let you know.
All right.
You know, Larry, that was a great interview. It actually brought me back to a project where this was, came to the forefront for me personally. This is right around when .NET first came out. I was working on a project for a logistics company where they had branch offices scattered all over the world. And we were building an application. It was a web-based application that needed to take into consideration a lot of the different language requirements for the different offices. And it's interesting. It's not as simple as just doing string replacements, right? Because there are some languages that kind of, read top to bottom. There's some languages that read from left from right to left versus left to right. And there's a lot of things you need to take into consideration. It's not an easy thing to do.
Right. And it is getting easier, as we move along in technology. I remember about, 12, 13 years ago, I was on a project to make a Spanish language version of a bill, for a company that, they do a lot of billing. They would send out their customer bills once a month, and they needed to just add a second language. Now, this was not to the actual application itself. This was just to the bill. And I recall that it cost like millions of dollars and, took many, many months. I think it was, even longer than a year. At the time, you had to do all of your globalization and localization from scratch. You had to add the tables to the database. You had to, make sure that, your processes were calling the right information and all that. It's gotten a lot easier with the .NET framework, and the operating systems understanding globalization and localization.
Yeah, the tools and technologies are definitely getting better. And so this isn't an old problem. All right. Or I'm sorry, this isn't a new problem, but it's a problem that's exists for quite a while. And, it is getting easier, but it's still a challenge. So with that, I guess we'll close out this week's show. Once again, thanks everybody for listening this week. And, as always, please send us your feedback, your comments, your concerns, suggestions for show topics at thirstydeveloperlive.com where you can reach us. And as well, you can comment on each show if you go to thirstydeveloper.com. Just go up there and add your comments to each posting of the particular podcast. And with that, I'm Dave Boss. You can reach me at daveboss.com. And my good buddy over there in Studio M, Larry Clarkin, you can reach him at larryclarkin.com. That's C-L-A-R-K-I-N.com. And you can find us both on Twitter and Facebook. With that, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. For more information, visit thirstydeveloper.com. We'll see you next time.
Both Larry and I have been a little tied down with some internal work that we've been doing this week.